Hello and welcome to Religion in the News. This is Brian LeBlanc for the North Carolina Reading Service, and for the next 30 minutes we'll be featuring articles from the Associated Press, from Religion News Service, from America Magazine, and more. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired, and all news is read exactly as printed. Podcasts of this and other episodes of Religion in the News may be found at our website at ncreadingservice.org. We begin this week on Religion in the News with an Associated Press article with a local tie. Unfortunately, it's kind of a sad story, but we always try to feature local articles as often as we can. The headline on this article, "Man Who Played Duke Chapel Bells for 50 Years Dies." And this is by Jonathan Drew of the Associated Press, Dateline, Durham. When J. Samuel Hammond arrived as a freshman at Duke University in 1964, he knew nothing about the musical instrument that allowed a player to send melodies ringing across campus from the bells in the school's iconic chapel tower. A demonstration from a fellow student introduced him to the 50-bell carillon that would become his life's work, as he played music that marked the end of the academic day for countless students. Hammond, who retired as university carillonneur in 2018 after playing the bells at Duke Chapel for 5 decades, died Thursday at age 73 in Durham, the university said in a news release. His music was heard each weekday by students leaving the day's classes, and more recently by alumni who could watch some of his performances online. Toward the beginning of each weekday afternoon's 15-minute performance, Hammond would pound out 5 strikes of the largest bell to mark 5 o'clock. Then he typically moved on to hymns and other sometimes whimsical selections, such as the movie themes from Star Trek or Star Wars, according to a university news article. He would often play songs to mark special occasions, such as the French anthem La Marseillaise on Bastille Day. When the basketball team played its arch rival from the University of North Carolina, he played the Duke fight song. "The carillon marks the rhythm of our days here at Duke, providing a shared experience that, sometimes subtly, connects us with one another, with traditions that stretch across centuries and continents, and even with God," the Reverend Luke A. Powery, Dean of Duke Chapel, said in 2018 when Hammond retired. "The person who has carried on that tradition at Duke for decades, faithfully and unassumingly, is Sam." The bells of the Gothic chapel are played by striking wooden keys by hand and pressing foot pedals, similar to a piano. The keys and pedals control cables that cause hammers to strike the bells, which range in size from 10 pounds to more than 5 tons, the university article said. It was physical work. A demonstration video posted by Duke at the time of his retirement shows Hammond shifting forward on his bench and putting his weight down to operate the largest bell when sounding the 5 o'clock chimes. As he commences the next tune, he leans in, and with subtle flowing movements, uses the side of his hand to strike the thin wooden keys that control smaller bells. The result is a buoyant melody emanating from the chapel's 210-foot tower. In addition to weekdays, Hammond also performed for Sunday chapel services and university events. The university said he played music on the bells an average of 300 times a year, estimating his performances exceeded 15,000. When he retired as carillonneur, 2 other musicians took over his duties. "The sound of those bells is omnipresent in the life of our community, but also unassuming, a gentle accompaniment to the rhythm of our days," Zebulon Hyben, director of chapel music, said in a statement Thursday. "This was Sam, too, omnipresent on campus, unassuming, deeply kind and thoughtful, humbly uninterested in the adulation he deserved." Hammond also earned 2 master's degrees in library science and theological studies and worked for 4 decades as a music librarian at the school. Hammond, who grew up in Americus, Georgia, enrolled at Duke in 1964 and learned how to play the carillon after a demonstration from a fellow student, Hammond recalled in 2018. "When I was a freshman at Duke, I met the student carillonneur at the time, John Simpson, when we studied organ together," Hammond said in the article about his retirement. "John invited me to see the carillon, of which I knew nothing, and in response to my intrigued interest in such an unusual instrument, and in a potential opportunity of being of service to the university, kindly provided me beginning instruction and ultimately the opportunity to play." He began playing regularly, according to the university article, and he was promoted to chapel carillonneur in 1968, the same year he graduated. In 1986, he was named university carillonneur, becoming the 2nd person to hold that position. Our next article this week on Religion in the News comes from Religion News Service, dated February 25th. United Methodists reschedule meeting and decision on splitting again. The subheadline, in the meantime, bishops have called for another special session. And this is by Emily McFarlane Miller of Religion News Service. The United Methodist Church has once again postponed its quadrennial meeting due to the COVID-19 pandemic, delaying further a widely anticipated vote by delegates from across the globe on a proposal to split the denomination over the inclusion of LGBTQ members. The United Methodist Church General Conference is now scheduled for August 29th to September 6th, 2022, at the Minneapolis Convention Center in Minneapolis. In the meantime, the denomination's Council of Bishops has called a special session of the General Conference that will meet May 8, 2021, online. Our current book of discipline was never written with a worldwide pandemic in mind, Bishop Cynthia Fierro Harvey, president of the Council of Bishops, said in a written statement about the special session. When we became aware of the need for a further postponement, we knew that some action needed to be taken in order to free the church to operate and continue to fulfill its current mission until we could gather in person. This is the second time the United Methodist Church, one of the largest denominations in the United States, has rescheduled its meeting of its top decision-making body, which will gather 862 delegates and other United Methodists from around the world. The quadrennial meeting had originally been set from May 5th to 15th of last year, also in Minneapolis. That meeting was rescheduled for August 29th to September 7th, 2021, when the Minneapolis Convention Center announced it was restricting events. Delegates to the General Conference are expected to take up a proposal to split the denomination called a Protocol of Reconciliation and Grace Through Separation. The proposal, negotiated by 16 United Methodist bishops and advocacy group leaders from across theological divides, would create a new conservative traditionalist Methodist denomination that would receive $25 million over the next 4 years. Calls to split one of the largest denominations in the United States have grown since the 2019 special session of the United Methodist General Conference approved the so-called traditional plan strengthening the church's bans on the ordination and marriage of LGBTQ United Methodists. The Commission on the General Conference made the latest decision to reschedule the General Conference at its meeting on Saturday, February 20th, according to the denomination. Commissioners decided they were not able to assure full participation of all General Conference delegates who travel from across the globe in either an in-person or a virtual meeting. The pandemic remains a threat as COVID-19 cases continue to rise, and a vaccine is not expected to be widely available this year in many countries, the denomination noted. New variants of the virus, including one originating in South Africa, also have been reported. The denomination also considered how the pandemic complicates travel for delegates from outside the U.S. International travelers to the U.S. must show proof of negative COVID-19 test results, but testing is not free or readily available in many places. Visa services also remain limited in some places. The Commission on the General Conference explored the possibility of holding the meeting virtually, as much of life has been lived online during the past pandemic year. However, a technology study team report laid out a number of issues with such a meeting, including a lack of infrastructure and technology in some places, concerns about credentialing and verifying the identity of voters and the security of voting. The study team did suggest delegates could use mail-in ballots to vote on emergency actions, according to the denomination. The use of paper ballots would allow for the fullest participation of delegates, according to Harvey. The virtual meeting in May will be limited to voting to suspend the rules to allow the use of such mail-in ballots, according to the Council of Bishops. That, in turn, will allow delegates to the special session to vote by mail on 12 pieces of legislation that will allow the denomination to continue its administrative functions appropriately until the postponed meeting in 2022. The legislation includes measures related to retirements and extending the last approved budget to the next General Conference meeting. It does not include measures related to the proposal to split the denomination, which the statement from the Council of Bishops said should be reserved for an in-person meeting where debate, amendment, and discernment could be conducted with integrity and full participation. Full participation on the part of all elected delegates is a justice issue that must not be ignored or sacrificed, Harvey said. This is why the convened session online must be confined solely to gaining permission for the mailed-in paper ballots. Our next article on religion in the news this week comes from America Magazine, which is the Jesuit Review of Politics and Society. And this is entitled, Catholics in Quebec Are Leaving the Church in Droves. Can Reinventing Parish Life Save It? And this is by Dean Detloff of America Magazine. In a pastoral message released in December, Cardinal Gérald Lacroix of the Archdiocese of Quebec announced a dramatic transformation in how the Catholic Church in the province should understand itself. Faced with declining resources and a faithful but increasingly small cohort of weekly mass attendees, between 2 and 11% of the province, according to The Economist in 2016, Cardinal Lacroix called on the church in Quebec not to struggle to hold on to what it has left, but to see itself as a mission church moving outward. We must reorient our pastoral teams toward a more intensely missionary activity, turn toward the people and groups that we join too little, the cardinal said. Cardinal Lacroix's decision is fully in tune with what the Quebec bishops have called the missionary turnabout, following Francis's Joy of the Gospel, said Frédéric Barrio, a researcher at the Jesuit-run Center for Justice and Faith in Montreal, in an email. For years, there were too many churches and too few priests and faithful to tend them. They needed to dispose of many of these aging and sometimes crumbling churches to kickstart the real church, the one that is not made of concrete brick and mortar, but of flesh, blood, and faith. In recent years, hundreds of churches in Quebec have been slated for demolition or conversions into mixed-use facilities, homes, theaters, and more, reflecting the waning presence of institutional Catholicism. The number of baptisms in the province has sharply declined. The economic effects of the COVID-19 pandemic have exacerbated the budget challenges of already struggling parishes. Still, 64% of people in Quebec identify as Catholic, according to the polling firm Angus Reid, even if weekly mass attendance is no longer the norm. Mr. Barrio suggests that out of such challenges may emerge new expressions of authentic Catholicism in the province. It means less parochial churches, priests, and Sunday masses, he said, and more smaller meeting rooms where laypersons would animate the liturgy of the word and be a sign of God's love for humanity by their personal and collective action for the common good. It is an opportunity to become the field hospital church that Francis so often speaks about. While the missionary direction may be new, Mr. Barrio insists that the church has a long tradition of engaging people in Quebec, especially through efforts in pursuit of social justice. To help explore that tradition, the Center for Justice and Faith has been compiling stories and information about past social justice campaigns by Catholics in Quebec in an online archival project, Mémoire du Christianisme Social au Québec. Young people in Quebec, according to Mr. Barrio, born after the Second Vatican Council and the so-called Quiet Revolution, when civic institutions in the province experienced rapid secularization, have never known the ultramontane and tridentine church of the past. They are rediscovering the prophetic heritage of Catholic social activists involved in labor, feminist, ecological, and decolonial struggles, he said. The church would be wise to tap into that vein with the hopes and dreams of Quebec's youth. The church in Quebec also has a rich living tradition of missionaries to draw upon, including those who have wrestled with what it means to preach the gospel under the province's unique conditions. Among them is the Reverend Claude Lacaille, who worked as a missionary with the Société des Missions Étrangères in some of the most difficult political contexts in Haiti, Ecuador, and Chile. Though he had to navigate dictatorships and violence abroad, he says his return to Quebec in 1986, after the province had secularized, was my most difficult mission of all. Father Lacaille left Quebec for Haiti in 1965, when most Quebecers were still practicing Catholics. He adapted himself well in foreign countries, he said. His memoir, Rebel Priest in the Time of Tyrants, is full of stories of enculturation, throwing in with the struggle of others, living alongside other missionaries, like the Mary Knoll sisters Edith Ford and Carla Piet. But when I came back to Quebec, secularism was something that I was not confronted with before, he says. In Chile, I was working all the time in my environment with communists, atheists, and so on. There was never a problem that I was a priest. He's on our side, they would say. But to be a priest in Quebec was a problem. That was difficult for me because I was surprised. I didn't know what to do. He soon became a chaplain for the Quebec Christian Student Movement, eventually joining about 20 others, including students, clergy, couples, and friends, who lived in the same neighborhood as a base community in Montreal. The main focus was the student movement, and this was a very important movement for all those people, he remembered. The people who participated in this Montreal community, he said, today are all committed as Christians in their environments. It produced a church, but it's a church of prophets. Father Lacaille eventually joined the Comité de Solidarité Trois-Rivières, an organization founded in solidarity with Chileans after the right-wing coup against President Salvador Allende in 1973. He continued his mission, building local and international solidarity. For Father Lacaille, converting the church in Quebec to a missionary role demands what he calls a prophetic pivot. We have to become a prophetic church dedicated to making the world a better place, Father Lacaille said. This is what Jesus wants, to take care of the poor, but also to change society so that it will be according to the will of God. We don't have to take out a new rabbit from our hat. Joseph Cardin, Dorothy Day, these are prophets that we have known before. We have to go on that path, I think. Mr. Barrio agrees. A prophetic church, like the one sought by Pope Francis, highlighting social justice and solidarity with the destitute and the persecuted, has the potential of closing the chasm between the church and the modern secular culture of Quebec. Both men say the energy and vision for this new church will come from among its young people. We have to present an alternative, said Father Lacaille. It will be difficult. I think that the Catholics of my age and generation and older might not be able to do it. I think we have to focus on youth and small communities. That was my experience in Haiti and in Chile. As the church in Quebec enters a new missionary phase, losing its buildings, staff members, and even some sources of income, it will need to find a way to adapt to a culture that remains suspicious of collars and habits. Father Lacaille and Mr. Barrio suggest that that means stepping out into the world, ready to meet the people of Quebec on their own terms, and speaking a prophetic word. Continuing on religion in the news this week, our next article is from Religion News Service once again. This article is entitled, SBC President J.D. Greer, God Did Not Call Southern Baptists to Save America. Subheadline, in a speech to the SBC Executive Committee meeting, Greer asked, do we want to be a gospel people or a Southern culture people? Which is the more important part of our name, Southern or Baptist? This article is from February 22nd by Bob Smetana of Religion News Service, Dateline Nashville, Tennessee. Southern Baptist Convention President J.D. Greer called out fellow Baptists on Monday, February 22nd, who he said were sowing dissension and lies in the nation's largest Protestant denomination. Greer, who pastors the Summit Church, a North Carolina megachurch, defended his 3 years as the denomination's president and the congregation and the convention's growing diversity. But he said political divides were distracting the convention from its mission work. We are not at our core a political activism group, he said in an address to the SBC's executive committee. We love our country, but God has not called us to save America. He's called us to build the church and spread the gospel, and that is our primary mission. In recent months, Southern Baptist leaders have been embroiled in a debate over critical race theory, an academic framework that seeks to explain systemic racism. Leaders of the denomination seminaries labeled CRT as incompatible with the SBC's statement of faith. That led several prominent black Southern Baptist pastors and congregations to announce they were leaving the denomination. Greer called his fellow Baptists to focus on the gospel instead of things that divide them, and the gospel, he said, demands diversity. If we are going to be gospel above all people, it means that we will be a church that engages all of the peoples in America, not just one kind, he said, and that's hard. Bringing together people of different backgrounds and cultures and ethnicities into the church creates challenges. Anybody that says it's not hasn't actually done it. While he said that he agreed with some of the concerns about CRT, he also lamented that criticism of it had alienated people of color, and he pledged to work harder on racial reconciliation. Some Southern Baptist leaders, including Greer and ethicist Russell Moore, have been accused of leading the denomination in a liberal direction because of their openness to addressing issues of race and social justice. Others were criticized for not being supportive enough of Donald Trump. Greer said COVID-19 has really revealed fault lines in the denomination. The last year has revealed areas of weakness in our beloved convention of churches, he said. Fissures and fault lines and fleshly idolatries. COVID didn't produce these crises, it only exposed them. Greer said that Southern Baptists have always come together to send out missionaries and to train leaders. He said the denomination spent years fighting to get its theology right. But its culture, he said, has failed at times to reflect that theology and was more shaped by Southern or conservative culture than the gospel. That culture has often made life difficult for people of color while allowing racists to be at home. We should mourn when closet racists and neo-Confederates feel more at home in our churches than do many of our people of color, he said. The reality is that if we in the SBC had shown as much sorrow for the painful legacy that racism and discrimination has left in our country as we have passion to decry CRT, we probably wouldn't be in this mess. Greer said that he and other SBC leaders have been lied about, called liberal, and accused of trying to destroy the convention. He then outlined some of his conservative credentials, his church's commitment to sending missionaries and baptizing new converts, his prayer at the U.S. Senate on the day that Supreme Court Justice Amy Coney Barrett was confirmed, and his belief that homosexuality is sinful. Greer also joked about rumors that he had received funding from progressive philanthropist George Soros and that he flew around the country in a private plane paid for with Southern Baptist donations. The SBC president said that he had seen neither a check from Soros nor an SBC-funded plane. He labeled lies about SBC leaders and entities as demonic and said that the SBC could no longer tolerate such sinful behavior from critics that he compared to the Pharisees, a religious group that opposed Jesus in the New Testament Gospels. Southern Baptists fought against liberal theology in the past, he said. They should also oppose those who tried to divide Baptists with lies. Brothers and sisters, in the 1980s, we repudiated the leaven of the liberals, a leaven that threatened to poison the gospel, he said. Are we now going to repudiate the leaven of the Pharisees, which can choke out the gospel just as easily? Those controversies, Greer said, distract from the denomination's largest mission. In the end, he said, Southern Baptists have to decide what is more important to them. Do we want to be a gospel people or a Southern culture people? Which is the more important part of our name, Southern or Baptist? We'll wrap up this week's edition of Religion in the News with an article from the Salt Lake Tribune dated February 26th. The headline, LDS Church Kicks in $20 Million Toward Global COVID Vaccination Push. Subheadline, Latter-day Saint Charity's contribution to UNICEF is the largest private donation to date and will help bring 2 billion doses to nearly 200 countries by year's end. This is by Peggy Fletcher Stack of the Salt Lake Tribune. Latter-day Saint Charities is donating $20 million toward UNICEF's global push to procure and distribute 2 billion COVID-19 vaccines in about 196 countries by year's end. The grant from the humanitarian arm of The Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints, the United Nations agency reported, is the single biggest contribution so far from a private sector partner toward the effort. Through the work of UNICEF's partners, Access to COVID-19 Tools, or ACT Accelerator, and the vaccines arm of the ACT Accelerator called the COVAX Facility, the doses will be given to frontline healthcare and social workers, as well as those who are at high risk or vulnerable to serious complications from the coronavirus. Some 600,000 of those doses are already on their way to Accra, Ghana, and the Ivory Coast. COVID-19 is the first truly global crisis we have seen in our lives. No matter where we live, the pandemic affects every person, including children, Henrietta Fore, UNICEF's executive director, said at a joint news release from the agency and the Utah-based faith. There has never been a more urgent need to work together. For its part, the church appreciates the partnership as well. UNICEF's team and organization have done so much to care for children and their families and help them meet basic needs and fulfill their potential, presiding Bishop Gerald Cossey, who oversees the faith's financial, real estate, investment, and charitable operations, said in the release. As more adults in vulnerable communities are vaccinated, critical health, nutrition, and educational services for children in need will be able to resume. We hold hope in our hearts not only of overcoming the pandemic, but of seeing a brighter future for all children and their families. This is not the first time the church has joined hands with the UN agency to fight the pandemic. Last year, it gave UNICEF $3 million to help provide water, sanitation, and hygiene services to countries struggling to cope with the virus. Indeed, Latter-day Saint Charities and UNICEF USA have been working together since 2013 on common goals related to children and their families, especially refugees. Providing global immunizations has been a long-standing priority for the 16.5 million member churches' humanitarian efforts. Since 2002, the faith has given financial support, according to the church's website, to prominent global immunization partners to procure and deliver vaccinations, monitor diseases, respond to outbreaks, train healthcare workers, and develop elimination and eradication programming. These efforts have resulted, the release said, in more immunized children and fewer lives lost to measles, rubella, maternal and neonatal tetanus, polio, diarrhea, pneumonia, and yellow fever. And to show their support for the current COVID-19 vaccines, the church's governing first presidency, Russell M. Nelson, Dallin H. Oaks, and Henry B. Eyring, provided photos of themselves getting vaccinated January 19th. The three said in a release that they urge church members, employees, and missionaries to be good global citizens and help quell the pandemic by safeguarding themselves and others through immunization. Latter-day Saint Charities reports it has participated in or led 1,050 COVID-19 relief projects thus far in 152 countries. We'll wrap up this week on Religion in the News by returning to a short story from the AP. Vaccinated for virus, Jimmy Carter and wife back in church. Dateline Plains, Georgia. Now that former President Jimmy Carter and his wife are vaccinated against COVID-19, they have returned to one of their favorite things, church. Maranatha Baptist Church in Tiny Plains, Georgia, announced on its Facebook page Wednesday that Carter, age 96, and Rosalind Carter, age 93, were again attending worship in person. The couple has been in the sanctuary the past two Sundays, Pastor Tony Loudon said in a video. Jimmy Carter hasn't resumed teaching his Sunday school class, which once drew thousands of visitors annually. But video from last Sunday's service showed both of the Carters sitting in their customary spots on the front pew and wearing face masks. The former president waved as members applauded their presence. "They've both had their shots," Loudon said from the pulpit. In a reminder to keep a safe distance from the couple, Loudon said if someone gets tackled by him, another man, or Secret Service agents, it's because we're still practicing social distancing. With the Carters once again in church, Maranatha Baptist posted rules that also include mandatory face masks and temperature checks, limited building capacity, reservations, and no photographs. Before the pandemic, visitors usually gathered around the couple for pictures at the end of worship. The Carters celebrated their 74th wedding anniversary last July and are the longest married presidential couple in U.S. history. We've reached the end of our time for this week on Religion in the News, and we appreciate you tuning in, and thank you so much for being a part of the program. I'm Brian LeBlanc for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Don't forget that you can get podcasts of this and other episodes of Religion in the News by visiting our website. Just head to ncreadingservice.org, click on the Listen tab, and then select the podcast section. We appreciate you being a part of the program this week and hope you'll be able to tune in again next time. I'm Brian LeBlanc, and this has been North Carolina Reading Service, Religion in the News.